7 falling out of the sky. I folded them crooked, now I'm wondering why I could always end up in the water. But nobody's asking why she's looking so thin, why she laughing too hard, why she drinking again. A falling star, she's a paper plane, and she was going down when you caught her. I built my house up on this rock, baby, every day with you. There's nothing in that town I need after everything we've been through. Me out in my garden and you out on your walk is all the distance this poor girl can take without listening to you talk. I don't need their money, baby, just you and me on.
Welcome to Scream Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in a hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Scream Therapy. Welcome to episode 100. I can't think of a better way to celebrate this Scream Therapy milestone than bringing back Sasha DeBruhl of Transformative Mental Health Practices. Sasha joined me on episode 28, way back in 2021. Her conversation affected me deeply and helped me on the path to stability. Since he last joined me, Sasha's been focusing on internal family systems therapy, or IFS, the idea that we all have different parts that need to be protected and nurtured, and that these parts are led by a core self that knows how to heal. Sasha has always been and will always be a punk at heart. He's been part of the punk and activist scene for 35 years. It's that punk attitude that has been integral in his criticisms of the mainstream mental health model. This has led him to internal family systems. With its self-empowerment message and self-care practice, IFS might just be the punk rock of therapy. Let's let Sasha explain it.
My name is Sasha Altman DeBruhl, and I have a master's in social work, and I work as a counselor for people who struggle with what get called extreme states of consciousness. So I work with a lot of people who've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or things like that. The kind of things that get you locked up in a psychiatric hospital. I'm going to be 50 years old in a couple months. And I grew up in New York City and was part of the punk scene there starting when I was 14. So that means that I've been around for a little while. I feel like punk rock really helped lay a foundation for me and my thinking about what it means to be like a healthy person in this world.
So you're the first return guest on the podcast, and I'm super happy to have you for episode 100. We talked in January 2021, which seems like forever ago. And you really came in at a time when I was trying to learn about myself and my diagnosis and It was a really pivotal time for me where I just started to accept what I was dealing with and looking for some guidance and some ideas on some of the concepts that were kind of in the back of my mind, but I didn't quite get yet. Things like disordered language and the idea of recovery and what diagnosis meant and what kind of touchstone it was in my journey. So I want to thank you for that. I'm really happy that I met you and that we talked. You're a big part of the book as well, the Scream Therapy book. So thank you so much, Sasha, for being back.
Oh, yeah, I'm super happy to be here. And full disclosure, my kids just turned 3 years old. I have three-year-old twins, and the past 3 years, I don't remember anything.
One of the promotional things that you send out with your practice and also just speaking engagements and stuff like that is this quote, "What if emotional sensitivities were seen not as mental illnesses to be cured, but as gifts to be managed in ways that help people thrive?" And I send that out quite a bit to my support group folks as well, because that really, to me, says it all. And the real pivotal time in my journey was just essentially that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something. In the last 3 years, especially because I've become a father, and I'm just fascinated by suddenly have these two little kids and a partner. I'm deep in a family system. I become really interested in family systems thinking and systemic family therapy. So for those of you who are listening, the way we think about mental health, the language that we use to talk about mental health is incredibly influenced by historical political changes that happened in the 1980s. There was the downfall of psychoanalytic thinking and the rise of biopsychiatry. Biopsychiatry starts from this premise that if we're going to understand what's going on with our mental health issues, we have to understand what's going on in our brain and our brain chemistry. But that's a very new idea. And it's questionable how useful it is. Sometimes it can be useful. You could maybe find a drug that works with the chemicals in your brain. It might be useful to take those drugs. But to actually learn how to work with other people or to understand social dynamics, I think there's lots of other ways to do it. So for me, I look back to the 1960s and 70s to people like Gregory Bateson, who was kind of considered the father of family systems therapy. And I have this quote here. It fits right into thinking about bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. So Bateson's theory of the double bind came from a theoretical attempt to imagine the kind of interpersonal communicational context in which psychotic ideas and symptoms would seem adaptive. Basically, what that's saying is, the world makes us crazy, and people start acting, especially kids growing up in complex, dysfunctional environments, will act in ways that seem crazy, but actually they're just trying to make sense of their world. And then we tell the kids that there's something wrong with them. But actually, if you look a little closer at the schools they go to and the social context, the families that they grow up in, their behavior actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and that's exactly what punk rock was all about. Is you're different, you're going to raise your hand to authority, well then something's wrong with you. You're now an outcast, you're now someone that needs to be dealt with in extreme situations, not even extreme situations, put in psychiatric wards and hospitals because, you're not falling in line. And I know that you went through that as well, and a lot of your friends did with the old New York scene that you grew up in.
Yeah, well, I was a kid who, I was living at home with my mom, and I ended up getting locked up in a psych ward when I was 18. A lot of my friends ended up in juvie. A lot of my friends were runaways, because back in those days in New York, there was a lot more leeway. It was the kind of city you could run away to and make a life for yourself. I don't know if it still works that way anymore. I think it's a little harsher now. But yeah, punk rock has always had that element to it, always, in its core. You could look at it from all different kinds of perspectives. And in general, I think the people who are different, the people who don't fit into society, are really important. They play a really important role. And in societies that are more healthy, they're respected and they're considered artists and they're given grants and they don't have to play by the same rules. And in societies that are not as healthy, people are out on the streets and people are doing a lot of drugs because there's no room for the ones who don't fit in. I think the way a society treats its weirdos is really important.
Going to the brain, I've been really hesitant to really even admit or address the idea of the brain chemistry. And I think it's because I've always felt even before diagnosis, that it was very much in my system. I didn't think about the thinking part of it. I was thinking more about how it felt. And there's just so many different factors built into why I'm dealing with what I am, and biological, genetics, the kind of therapy I've had over the years, my trauma from the past, all these things come together in a way that really, I think people discredit by saying my brain is lacking this chemical, my brain is broken. Trying to figure out a way to come to terms with the fact that, yes, that is part of it. I don't believe in the broken brain, but those chemicals. It's been really tough.
One of the things about human beings, we communicate in language, and language is very mysterious. It seems kind of normal. Oh, we're just talking back and forth right now, understanding what we're saying. But we're using this tool that was not created by us. Other people made up these words. I think because we live in such an individualist society, we tend to look at people and say, oh, that individual right there has a biological brain disease, or that individual right there has a personality disorder, or that individual right there, you know, has something that's different about them. Maybe that can be useful sometimes. But if you're like you and I struggling with mental health issues in this world, it can be way more useful to look at ourselves and see how we relate to everybody else and what role we're playing. Because one of the things about systemic family therapy that they found back in the 60s was that, like, if one person was diagnosed with schizophrenia, let's say, in a family, and then that person got better or left, somebody else would get sick. I myself am not into the brain chemistry language. We could use that language. Maybe it could be helpful. But frankly, after billions of dollars of research, they still don't really know what they're talking about. When they say, like, oh, someone has a chemical imbalance, that's just a metaphor. They don't really know anything about chemical imbalances. And for anyone out there who is hearing my words and doesn't know who I am, let me just tell you, I spent a bunch of years working at the New York State Psychiatric Institute, which is like the most powerful psychiatric institute in the world that raises the most amount of money to do like schizophrenia research. And so I feel like after having that experience, after being in like punk rock world and doing everything that I was doing, I can say for certain that whole worldview is, it's really not like talking about brain chemistry. Maybe it makes some people feel better somehow. Oh, well, it's just the chemicals in my brain. It's not my behavior. But I think we can do better than that.
In some ways, it almost absolves from responsibility. It's a tough one. For me, I was always afraid to point there because I felt like I want to be under control. I want to be able to own my own behavior. I want to be able to understand why. And I want to be able to treat people in ways that doesn't single them out as being sick or disordered or whatever. I've been getting away from the word disorder right from the get because I just felt like it didn't fit. It felt really icky to me. It felt like it was putting me in a place I didn't want to be.
I hear it in like a British Johnny Rotten voice. I don't take it seriously. After all these years, I just don't. I'm diagnosed bipolar 1 with psychotic features. I even take the drugs. I've been taking lithium carbonate for 23 years. We can have a conversation about that. But when it comes down to it, I very strongly believe, and I think that this is very useful thinking for people like us, for people like you who are struggling to figure out your relationship to diagnoses, and for anyone else listening, it can be incredibly useful. It can be incredibly liberating to think about ourselves, not just as individuals, but as having a bunch of different parts. This is how my practice works. Like, someone comes to see me, maybe they've been given some really intense diagnosis and they've been in the psych ward a bunch. I don't look at them for a second like, oh, this person is disordered. I want to know what's going on inside of them. What are the dynamics that are happening inside of them? And when I say inside of them, I don't mean their flesh and blood. I mean in their unconscious. What are the things that are affecting the way that they're thinking? And what I've learned from being in this role as a therapist for a number of years now is that we all have different parts of ourselves that have relationships with each other. And oftentimes, when we think that we're thinking, what we're actually doing is we're listening to different parts of ourselves talk. And what that means is that if you are someone who, let's say, you get really intense, violent thoughts in your head about killing people, just disturbing images, you know, about like whatever. Okay. Rather than saying, oh, wow, I'm really screwed up. I'm a really screwed up person. I need to be on drugs to make my brain not do that. You switch your perspective and you're like, oh, there's a part of me that's really hurt. There's a part of me that has some things that it wants to say, that it wants to hear, and no one's listening to it. So how do we listen to the parts that are saying like the most intense, like extreme things? And how do we learn to be curious about the stuff that's seemingly the most scary? And that's the heart of the practice that I have in working with people.
You mentioned medications, and I also had been on them right from the point of diagnosis, which has been 6 years now. It was in 2018. Wow, time flies. But a lot of the folks in the support group talk about wanting to go off the medications and the side effects that come with them and the feeling of wanting to be more excited and more on the hypomanic side and getting things done. And I always say, well, you know, what's worse, the side effects and sort of that feeling of emptiness in some ways, or the actual symptoms of the condition, you know, like trying to address what's going on. But for me, I've always stayed on because I felt like, you know, I finally got this mix of medications that seemed to work and keep me stable. And I'm actually quite afraid to now like look at, okay, well, what's better than that? Can I go the other direction and see how much I can test it? I've been like, nah, you know, I'm a punk rocker. I like to get out there and test. But in this case, I just feel like I'm quite scared.
Something must have happened back there that really scared the hell out of you.
Yeah, yeah.
There must be stuff in your life that you really want to make sure that you're taking care of and that you don't want to lose control of. Well, the thing I'd say to you is, and to anyone who's in your groups that are talking about that feeling of like, oh, I don't feel like how I want to feel, I think it's really important to figure out what's most important to us. I probably talked about this the last time you interviewed me, but for a bunch of years, me and my friends ran this thing called the Icarus Project, which was like a network of peer-based mental health support groups. So it was like by and for people diagnosed with things like bipolar disorder. And one of the things I learned from being a part of that group for so many years is that people have really different relationships to the psychiatric medication. For some people, it's really helpful, and for some people, it's a poison. And I think the ability to be able to figure out what works well for you. I somehow manage to still be pretty crazy sometimes, even though I take my meds. I don't know what it was like for you, but because for me it was so long ago, but when they first locked me up in the psych ward, one of the things that they told my mom was that, because I was 18, and they told her, if he goes off the meds, it's going to be dangerous. They called it the kindling effect. This idea that there's like a fire in his brain, not having the meds will make the fire come back. And the more time he spends being psychotic, the greater the chances he's just going to end up schizophrenic, like out on the streets talking to himself, you know? So make sure he stays on the meds. And my feeling, I wish that we lived in a different kind of society. I wish we lived in a kind of society that really recognized people's ability to be able to transform and change. What I think happened when I was 18 years old was I had a psychotic break, kind of like that quote that I read at the beginning about Gregory Bateson. I was acting in a way that made sense for the circumstances that I was in. I was trying to hold some really intense double binds that I had had since I was a kid. And instead of dealing with those binds, they just put me on a whole bunch of meds, and all that stuff just stayed there in my brain. You ever listen to the Subhumans? Not the Canadian Subhumans, but the British Subhumans?
I love them.
Yeah. I didn't hear them for a long time, but yeah, I saw the Subhumans the other day play. But there's that song, Animal, and it's like, ever since they put you away, you don't seem quite the same. They cut off all your lovely hair and gave you a brand new brain. Sent to the university because that was the next step up. Studying sociology, they gave you a plastic cup. What happened to you with your brand new brain? What'll they do when they get you again? Animal, they're coming to get you, Animal, because you went insane. that was my life story, you know? I mean, I had this unresolved stuff I couldn't deal with. They locked me up. They put me in a bunch of drugs. And then I went off the drugs. I had 6 years of my life where I was going and doing all kinds of interesting stuff with my life. But then I got locked up again. And it was like that unresolved stuff, that stuff that I didn't process when I was 18, came right back. And all these years later, I'm going to be 50 years old. I'm still dealing with that unprocessed stuff. I mean, it makes me an interesting guy, but it's also like, God, I guess what I'll say is this. I don't think in a healthy society that young people should just get put on large doses of antipsychotic meds. I just don't think so. I think that in a healthy society, we would let young people go through the kind of process that they need to go through to be able to get to the other side of it and integrate it into their lives. But that's not the kind of world that we live in. We live in a world where you got to get up and go to work in the morning. We live in a world where you got to get up and go to school. That's how you measure productivity.
Yeah, this concept of people being a danger to society, and you turn that around and use the concept of dangerous gifts, which I love. I think that pretty much says it all. I mean, I've got gifts that I can explore, but I need to be very careful about where those gifts are going and how am I on the right track. Do these gifts make sense in the context of what I want to be, who I am, being very delicate about them? And that's a flip around on the idea that they're a danger. Let's pump them to the medication. Let's put them in the hospital. That's something that you've turned around. Even the idea of the Icarus Project, this person that has these wings, and at any time, this person can fall from the sky.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very countercultural idea, right? It's not a mainstream idea. It would be very hard to translate that into the mainstream system. If you wanted to, you'd have to totally rebuild the mainstream system. I spent 3 years of my life working in first episode psychosis programs. That's finding young people having their first break of psychosis and trying to get them the services that they need. And I was in charge of developing the peer specialist role for all these first episode psychosis programs. And it was cool in some ways because I reached a lot of people, but also fundamentally the way the system works, there needs to be a larger shift in society. The biomedical model still has a stranglehold. So I think it's a Marxist word, hegemony. It's basically this, like, whatever the dominant forces in society, biopsychiatry is the dominant force in the mental health system. It used to be psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis was the dominant force, and everyone used the psychoanalytic language. Whatever is the dominant force is going to end up being really oppressive. So biopsychiatry is really oppressive. Psychoanalysis was really oppressive. Now it's not the dominant force, and it's not going to be oppressive. I hope that at some point in the future, someone will be listening to this podcast and biopsychiatry will have fallen and it'll take its rightful place somewhere where it's like, yeah, great, the drugs are really useful, but don't shove them down every kid's throat. That medical model is like, it's about laziness. It's about like not wanting to actually pay attention to people. And that's because people like us who get diagnosed with these like intense psychiatric disorders, we reflect the pain of society, and society don't want to look at it. I don't know what it's like where you live, but I've lived in big cities. So New York, where I'm from, or Los Angeles, where I am now, you walk down the street and there's folks living in tents who are all dirty and they're talking to themselves, and everyone just walks right by them. They don't want to acknowledge that they exist. They're like a shadow. Everybody has shadows. We all do. And what your shadow is, this is a Jungian idea. This shadow is the part of yourself that you're not conscious of, that you're scared of. So everyone has individual shadows. And I think in some ways the work of life is to like work through and discover what your shadows are and befriend them and make sure that usually they actually like bring you a lot of power. Well, society also has shadows, and society shadows the crazy homeless people. So there's that quote by Martin Luther King. It's like a less known quote of his. He says, human salvation lies in the hands of the creatively maladjusted. The people who are going to change the world are not the normal people. The people who are normal, who fit in to the society that we're living in, well, yeah, they're all right. You know, we like them just fine. But they're not going to be the ones that are going to push things forward. Because for them, it's like, It's all the things that are like lukewarm in society, all the like heterosexism and racism and all that stuff that's like just feels like it's normal. It's not going to be the people who fit in who are going to change things. It's going to be the people who are like, no, I can't deal with this. I'm freaking out and I need to do something.
With the dangerous gifts you talk about on your website about helping people learn how to use those gifts. So what does that look like? What kind of tools do you give them, or are things that you're able to talk to them about that would help them do better and make them feel alive rather than them being told that, oh, this gift is a bad thing. Like, don't even go there.
All right. I'm going to give you a really quick lesson in internal family systems thinking. Okay. So the idea, right? We were just talking about like groups of families or in social, like how dynamics are. But in individuals, we also have a bunch of different parts. And here's how we talk about them. So everybody has parts that are exiles. They're exiled. They're the parts of us that carry pain. They're the parts of us that have like the traumatic memories. You could think about them like people. They're like children, often like little kids. In fact, my first IFS teacher, she said this thing to me many years ago. She was like, if you're freaking out, if you're having a really hard time, it's almost like you're on a school bus full of screaming children. And the really important question you want to ask yourself is, who's driving the bus? Who's driving the bus? Are the kids at the wheel? Are they like crashing into the oncoming traffic? Or is there like some part of you that can be in the lead? And so in the IFS model, there's exiles, and then there's like protector parts, which is like the parts that like help you get stuff done during the day. And then everybody has a self. And everybody has the self. Everybody, no matter who you're talking about, the two of us, you, Jason, everyone you know, everybody has a self that is fundamentally curious and compassionate and creative and courageous and clear and has a sense of connection to something larger. Everybody has that. And that's the part that you want to be in the lead. That's the idea. So to answer your question about like, how do you learn to use your dangerous gifts? First, you have to understand who you are. Maybe there's, you have a part of yourself that you can see things really clearly, but then with that clarity also comes a whole bunch of anger. Okay, well, you need to get to know those parts and get to understand them. They're like inside of you. And a lot of times our parts, especially our exiled parts, they're like trapped in the past. I have parts in me that are from like the early 1980s, and they're children, and they are freaked out and they want to be taken care of. And then I have different ways of taking care of them, some of them more healthy than others. And the way you learn to use your dangerous gifts is you have to get to know your system.
That was Scream Therapy episode 100 with Sasha DeBruhl. SashaDeBruhl.com. For more episodes of Scream Therapy, go to ScreenTherapyHQ.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Big news, the Scream Therapy book is available now. Scream Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to ScreenTherapyHQ.com. For merch, check out Scream Therapy on TeePublic. Okay, enough promoting, it's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Scream Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening.